As a kid, some of my most joyful memories of Christmas morning were opening some of my favorite toys, many of which were Star Wars toys. And I was a big fan then, I still am today, and so I am excited and eagerly anticipating the release of the 9th and final movie in the saga this Friday. My wife loves me and has already bought tickets for us for opening night. Thinking ahead to the movie, Amy and I were pondering, hey, you know what, maybe we should watch all of the other movies to kind of get us up to speed for this final movie. And then we started counting and realized that there are 10 movies, and that's more than 20 hours of watching Star Wars. We don't have time. We don't have time to do that between now and when the movie comes out. There's no way. But we did go back and we watched the first movie released back in 1977, Star Wars, whose actual title wasn't Star Wars, but A New Hope. And interestingly, Star Wars, A New Hope, the 1977 movie that started all of this, is not the first story in this series. It is actually the fourth chapter. George Lucas made an interesting decision to begin this monumental, multi-billion dollar franchise by starting the story partway through. He always envisioned 9 movies, 3 sets of 3 movies each. So 3 trilogies, each of which is like an act of a play. And so each trilogy is an act in a 3-act play. And he began with the first scene of Act 2. And if you've watched that movie, the movie opens and you have no idea what is going on. All you know is that the good guys are being chased by the bad guys, and the bad guys are pretty scary. And so then you're kind of picking up the story partway through. Now, 42 years later, those of us who have been immersed in the story are really looking forward to the conclusion of this epic saga and this series of movies. Now, this is actually a similar experience that many of us have with our encounter with the Christian faith, with this God's story of redemption of creation. Many of us in the West are first introduced to Jesus through Christmas. Picking up the story of Jesus at his birth, following the story through his life, his ministry, his death, and resurrection, is typically how most of us come to faith. This is how we learn the story. But there is so much background that happened before Jesus, that leads up to Jesus, that sets the stage for Jesus and explains and gives context to his arrival and his ministry. Just as there are now 3 Star Wars episodes that are the background for the original set of movies, we have a background for the story of Jesus that's called the Old Testament. And that actually leads us to another connection with Star Wars, because watching the first 3 episodes of Star Wars is kind of like reading the Old Testament. Partway through, your eyes start to cross and you say, oh my goodness, this is really hard to get through, but you persevere. There are some good bits for sure, but overall, those first 3 movies and overall the Old Testament can be a heavy slog. But not only do we look back at the Old Testament, just as there are new Star Wars movies coming out, just as we look forward to the climactic conclusion coming out this Christmas, as Christians, we look forward to the climactic conclusion of the story of God's redemption of us and all of creation. We're not looking forward to a movie in that case. We're looking forward to the return of Christ and the redemption of us and our bodies, but also all of the created order that God set forth and set in motion way back in Genesis 1 that has been poisoned by sin all the way back to Genesis 3. The joy that the angel announced on that first Christmas night, Luke chapter 2, the shepherds are in the fields watching their flocks at night. The angel appears and says to them, I have triumphal good news that will be joy for all the people. The joy the angel announced was for all the people. Now, the shepherds wouldn't have grasped what exactly the angel meant in that moment. This is not just joy for the couple, Mary and Joseph, and the joy of a birth of a new child. This is not just the joy for Bethlehem that, hey, a baby's been born in town, isn't this wonderful? That's not what it meant. And it wasn't even, as you read Luke's gospel, as you read his second volume, the book of Acts, we see that the joy the angel announced wasn't even just the joy for Israel. If it was just the joy for Israel, then over those two volumes, you would have seen Jesus get rid of the Roman influence in Israel. The Romans would have been kicked out of Jerusalem if this joy for all the people was just the joy for all of Israel. The joy that the angel announced for all the people was even greater than conquering the Roman Empire. So what is this joy that we celebrate in Advent, right? We lit the candle of joy. What is the joy that we are talking about? Now, our culture has a lot of confusion about joy, which is why we probably struggle with this question of what is joy. We often equate joy with excitement and pleasure. We enjoy something because it's exciting, or because it's pleasurable, or because we enjoy, and we think that that is all that joy is. At Christmas, we think of the joy of giving and receiving gifts. And yes, there is an extent of joy in generosity. There is an extent, an element of joy in receiving gifts. That's true, but that joy is so often short-lived, right? How often is it that the toy or the gift that brought so much joy on Christmas morning, 3 months later, is gathering dust in the corner? So the joy of giving and receiving on Christmas is there, but it is remarkably short-lived. In our search for joy as a culture in the West, a very affluent culture, we often pursue more and more excitement, more and more pleasure. So we look for the next big thing, the next experience, the next product. And we chase these things, thinking that because a little bit of it gave us a little bit of joy, a lot of it will give us a lot of joy. But the abiding joy that we are searching for doesn't come from excitement or pleasure. The abiding joy that we really want comes from something much deeper. That's not, and so the joy of excitement and pleasure is not the kind of joy that the angel was referring to on that first Christmas when he announced the birth of Jesus. What joy did he mean? I would invite you to turn with me to two passages that we don't normally equate with Christmas. If you would like to read along and you don't have a Bible with you, raise your hand nice and high. We can get one to you. We're going to read first from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. If you have one of the church's Bibles, that's on page 852. And then I want you to find Revelation 5. Put a bookmark in there. If you didn't use your welcome card or your prayer request card, you can stick that in Revelation 5. We're not going to read it right away. We're going to read it when we come to it. But that's on page 869. So first find Hebrews chapter 12, 1 to 3. Page 852, and then put a bookmark in page 869, Revelation chapter 5, verses 1 to 14. These passages, as I mentioned, are not traditional Christmas passages, but they are passages about joy. And we're talking about joy, and we're talking about what the real joy of Christmas should be about, and so we're going to go to some passages that aren't, quote, Christmas passages, but they are joy passages. Hebrews 12, beginning at verse 1. The author says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. What's happening here? The author of Hebrews has just spent chapter 11 describing thousands of years of faithful followers of God. He describes great men and women of the faith who persevered through times of trouble, who faced all sorts of opposition. And he's reminding the Hebrew readers, the Jewish Christian readers, of their heritage. He's reminding them of all of the great heroes of Israel in the past and their faithfulness to God. He's writing to Christians who, if you read carefully chapter 10, these Jewish believers have already undergone persecution before. They underwent a persecution, they endured, they were zealous for God, and the persecution passed. But now, a time later, probably a number of years later, they're facing opposition again. They're facing renewed persecution. And this time, after years of ease and a lack of persecution, this time they're starting to stumble. They need to be encouraged. They need to have their zeal renewed. They're giving up, or they're veering towards giving up, at least, is the fear of the author of Hebrews. And so the author is pointing them to the men and women who have gone before and remained faithful to encourage them to remain faithful, even as they did years ago. So this great cloud of witnesses that the author describes are these great heroes of the faith of chapter 11 that he's just gone into great detail describing. But these witnesses, they're not witnesses of our marathon race. We often read this and we think that, oh, this great cloud of witnesses is in like the heavenly bleachers or the heavenly stadium, and they're all looking down at us running our marathon and they're witnessing us. There is an element of that, but that's not the primary element, because that's not the primary meaning of the word witness. They're not witnesses of our race, they're witnesses of God's faithfulness in their race. So the great cloud of witnesses are not witnesses of our race, of our marathon, they're witnesses of God's faithfulness from when they ran the marathon. Their lives are testimonies to the faithfulness of God, which is an encouragement to those who are running the marathon behind them. Inspired by their witness to God's faithfulness, inspired by their example of running well, we are told that we should do everything we can to cast off anything that hinders us from running, anything that entangles us and causes us to stumble and fall. Now, this could be an entangling or a habitual sin of some sort, of course, but it can also be things that are otherwise good. Work is a good thing, but if work takes priority over Jesus, it has become a hindrance to be cast off. Family is a good thing, but if it takes priority over Jesus, it becomes a hindrance in the race. This is why Jesus said to those who would follow him, you must hate your father and mother, your brother and sister, etc. Because he recognizes, even in a culture, an ancient culture like Israel's, where family was so important, he said, these things, as good as they are, can become a hindrance to following me. And I'll say, as a pastor in the 21st century, I have a family now, but I've been watching many years as other people have been raising kids. It is an easy temptation today to let family take priority over Jesus. It's amazing how often our commitment to Jesus, our obedience to Jesus, our service to Jesus is sacrificed on the altar of family. And it's sad, because family is a wonderful gift from God. And yet we sometimes allow it to become a hindrance in running the marathon of faith. And so we have to cast off even good things. And that doesn't mean if you have a family, you get rid of them. Right? It doesn't mean if you have a job, you quit. Oh, I'm not going to work. It means we have to cast off whatever part of it is a hindrance to our running the marathon of faith. We have to prioritize our obedience and our marathon and persevere. This also points out the Christian life is a marathon. It requires perseverance. It requires repeated decisions, repeated commitments. The Christian must exert effort to live faithfully. In all of our discussion of salvation by grace, not by works, sometimes we then think we don't have to work when we become a Christian. We think, oh, well, that's salvation by works. No, it isn't. That's called obedience by works, right? It's called faithfulness by works. You are saved by grace through the work of Christ, but you are saved for the good work that God prepared in advance for you to do. And so again, the Christian life is not, oh, one-time decision, and I'm going to then be, you know, did you know that 5 years ago I decided I was going to be a marathon runner? Now, I haven't actually done anything since then. I don't actually run. I don't eat well. I don't exercise. I don't stretch. But I decided to be a marathon runner, so I must be, right? We know that's not how it works when you run a marathon. Similarly, when you are called to run the marathon of faith, just because you made a decision at one point, I'm going to be a marathon runner, doesn't actually make you a marathon runner. It takes effort, perseverance, commitment, sacrifice, perseverance, and effort. Okay. We are also told to run our race well, we need to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. We are so easily distracted. This little gif is the dog is sitting there talking. He's been given a mechanical collar that allows him to talk. And he's talking about how great his master is, and squirrel! So easily distracted. I don't think we're a whole lot better than the dog who, squirrel! Our eyes are so easily drawn away from our Lord. Shiny things, exciting things, take our eyes off of Jesus. Hard things, difficult things, disappointing things, take our eyes off Jesus. You know, I am increasingly becoming aware of how often it is disappointment in the Christian life that leads people to fall away. They're disappointed that life hasn't turned out the way that they wanted, that God hasn't given them what they thought that he would give them, they're disappointed that life has become harder than they thought it would be. And that is far more often what leads people to abandon faith than any questions of theology. They're often cloaked or phrased in questions of theology, but the emotional experience of disappointment in life is far more often what takes people's eyes off Jesus than anything else. We are so easily distracted from keeping our eyes on Jesus. But it is keeping our eyes fixed on him that enables us to run with endurance, to endure hardship, to endure disappointment, and even to endure death. You know, if you read the second half of Hebrews chapter 11, the people described there did not have a happy ending. Jesus is the author and perfecter of our faith. He drew us to himself. He opens the door of salvation. He also then empowers us to walk through it and empowers us to run the marathon, which is why we need to keep our eyes fixed on him and not be distracted. Jesus fixed his eyes on joy, and it allowed him to even endure the cross. We fix our eyes on Jesus. Jesus had his eyes fixed on the joy set before him. And what was that joy? What was the joy that Jesus was fixed on that allowed him to run his race of obedience to the Father with such perseverance? He endured the cross. Well, the second half of that verse says, sitting down at the right hand of God, of the throne of God. Right? He endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Well, that's why we're going to read Revelation chapter 5. Because the joy of Jesus is described in great detail there. So if you did bookmark it, turn to Revelation chapter 5. We sang a number of songs this morning with images and verses taken from Revelation 5. So hopefully that kind of set the stage and kind of reminded you, and you'll pick up on some of that as we read through. I'm going to read the whole chapter. We're not going to exegete the whole thing. Don't worry. But we're going to kind of burn through this quickly and set the stage. In chapter 4, which is part of this, we see the throne of God encircled by the bejeweled rainbow, which is a sign of God's covenant. In the around the throne are four creatures who represent all of the animal kingdom. You have the ox and the eagle, the lion and the man. These are representatives of the categories of animal nature. And so they're there worshiping God. There are 24 elders, so 12 for the tribes of Israel, 12 for the apostles and the foundation of the church. And they're all worshiping God. They're worshiping the one on the throne. And then pick up the beginning of chapter 5. Then I, John, the one seeing the vision, saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or even look inside. And then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." And then I saw a lamb. He was told to look for the Lion of the tribe of Judah, and he sees a lamb. The lamb, looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. He had seven horns, he had seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He came and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. When he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints, and they sang a new song. "You are worthy to take the scroll and open its seals, because you were slain. And with your blood you purchased men for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on earth." And then I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders, and in a loud voice they sang, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." And then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them singing, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever." The four living creatures said, "Amen!" And the elders fell down and worshiped. This is the joy set before Jesus for which he endured the cross. Now, all of these figures are worshiping God. John sees a scroll on the arm of the throne. Now, a scroll with seven seals in the Roman Empire was somebody's last will and testament. And seven different people witnessed their will and put their seal on it. And it was up to those seven people when the person died. If any were left of those seven, it was their job to then open the scroll and be the executors of the will. And so here on the throne of God, you see God's will. And nobody is able to open up and carry out God's will. And that's why John weeps. Nobody can carry out the will of God. And the elder says, "Wait, behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, he is able to carry out the will of God." And so John looks and he sees a lamb, a little lamb that looks like it's been sacrificed, but it's still alive, or rather alive again. And so the lamb is a living slain lamb, because slain lambs don't live. And this living slain lamb is able to walk to the throne, get up on the throne, open the scroll, and carry out the will of God. And then the four creatures and the 24 elders, they take their worship from the one on the throne and start worshiping the lamb, which is profound. In the presence of God, all eyes turn to the living slain lamb. In the presence of God, all eyes turn to the living slain lamb, Jesus. This is, again, what part of the scriptural testimony that Jesus is the Son of God, that he is divine, because you don't worship anything other than God, especially in the presence of God. So the slain lamb is part of the Trinity. But what is it that these people sing? they sing a new song, because every time God does a new act in the world, when there's a new act of creation, a new activity of God, it deserves a new song. And throughout the Old Testament, there are new songs for God's new activity. So there's now new activity. God has done something new. And the content of that song describes the new thing God has done, that the Lamb is worthy because he was slain. And that by his blood, he has purchased people from every tribe, every language, every nation, every people. No longer are the people of God restricted to Israel. These purchased people are made into a kingdom and priests to serve God on earth. Now, the role of a priest is to bring God to people and people to God. As Baptists, we talk a lot about the priesthood of all believers. We need to remember what that means. It doesn't just mean that we have access to God, which it does. It means we also have the responsibility, with our access to God, to bring God to people who don't know him, or even to bring God to other fellow believers who do know him, and to bring people to God. That is the role of a priest. And so he has made these people to be a kingdom and priests for God. He has made these people that he has purchased to be people who bring God to the world and bring the world to God. And so as a result of this work of the Lamb, the worship ripples out from the creatures and the elders to a host of angels. And the angels sing that the Lamb is worthy to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength because of this work. And then every creature on earth and under the earth and in the sea is caught up in this wave of worship responding to what the Lamb has done. The wave goes out to all of the world and then comes back, and the elders and the four creatures, and they say amen, and they fall down and worship again. This is the joy set before Jesus that allowed him, motivated him to endure the cross. Revelation 5 describes the joy set before Jesus for which he actually scorned the cross. The worship, purchasing people to be a new kingdom, priests of God, to bring God to the world and the world to God. This is the joy that Jesus had. This was his motivation to endure suffering, to be scourged, to be crucified. This is the joy for which Jesus ran the marathon of obedience to God. It didn't make the crucifixion pleasant. It was excruciating. The word excruciating actually comes from the word for crucifixion. Crux, cruz, crucifix. It's all in there. Excruciating is the word that comes out of crucifixion because it's so horrible. But for the joy of purchasing people from every language and tribe and nation, for the joy of purchasing those people to then bring God to the world and bring the world to God, for that joy, Jesus endured the excruciating experience of the cross and died to redeem us and reconcile us to God. This is the joy for all the people that the angel talked about to the shepherds. This is the joy of Christmas. This is the triumphal good news that the angel announced to the shepherds. This is what Christmas is about, because this is what Christmas leads to. At Christmas, God began a new work in the world. It's called the Incarnation. God the Son becomes a human being. God himself comes to earth, becomes a human in order to save the earth. This is the joy of Christmas. So what then do we do to apply this? We have a lot of things that we talk about at the joy of Christmas. We rarely talk about the crucifixion. We apply this by considering what it means for those of us running the marathon of the Christian faith. How do we run well? We fix our eyes on Jesus. At the best of times, we are easily distracted. Lots of things compete for our attention. We are all busy. We are all overstimulated. Lots of things draw our eyes to themselves away from Christ. As I mentioned, shiny things, exciting things draw our eyes. Sad things, hard things, disappointing things draw our eyes to themselves away from Jesus. You know, in the parable of the sower and the seed, the different bad soils that seed fall on and don't produce a crop are described as consisting of both difficulties and trials, but also the pleasures and riches of life. All of these serve to pull our eyes off of Jesus so that we don't produce fruit. We are attacked from both sides, pleasure and pain. But in both cases, we need to keep our eyes on Jesus. Christmas is a time when our eyes are easily drawn away from Jesus. There's lots of shiny, glittery things at Christmas. There's lots of pleasures that the wealth and abundance of the West bring at Christmas, and they can draw our eyes away from Jesus. They make us forget the living slain Lamb who has bought us and forged us into a new people, a kingdom and priests to God. Similarly, Christmas can be at a time that we are reminded of hardship and loss. In our prayer time, you know, Dave was honest and he said, you know, Christmas is a time where a lot of people struggle. That's true. There are a lot of charged emotions at Christmas. We are reminded of disappointing and hurtful relationships. We are reminded of loss. People who were once here who are no longer. We're reminded of broken relationships. We're reminded of the hard parts of the marathon of faith and even sometimes disappointment in God that he didn't do what we expected. In these times, we must remember to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus. The Christian life requires sustained effort, and that includes sustained effort to keep our eyes on him. We must be consistently examining what is it in our life that may be entangling us, may be hindering us from running. And then we must actively tear it out, rip it off, throw it away. These things may be good things in and of themselves, but they have become a hindrance in our race. They may be painful things. Perhaps we have to cast away unfulfilled expectations of what life was supposed to be like. Maybe we have to throw away unmet expectations of what our Christian experience would be. We've got to cast these things away, refix our eyes on Jesus, and remember that he ran through the cross to attain the joy set before him. God has designed our lives for a collision course with the world. He has not designed our lives to go along merrily with the world. He's designed our lives to bump into the world. As a kingdom and priests of God, our joy will unfold here on earth as well as in heaven. Fixing our eyes on Jesus means seeing what he has done in the heavenly realm and living that out in our lives here on earth. Being God's people to bring people to God who don't know him, to bring God to those people, to bring God to people who do know him but need encouragement in their race, bearing one another's burdens. That is our role as priests, to be mediators between the world and God. This puts us on a collision course with the values of the world that has rejected God. Our goals, our desires, our motivations are different from what the world values, and that means there will be conflict. Sometimes that conflict will just be competing priorities. How do I prioritize my faith over other things? Sometimes that conflict will be angry or potentially even violent. But that is what we have been set apart for by God to do. And this includes at Christmas, when we meet with family who don't know Jesus, when we meet with family who are flagging and failing in their marathon run of faith, we are sent to bring them to God and bring God to them. Look at those witnesses who have gone before us to see the faithfulness of God. Not just to see their faithfulness to God, but to see God's faithfulness to them. This is why the great cloud of witnesses is so important. Not that we're on the stage, but that God has already shown in their lives that he is faithful. When we are on a collision course with the world, it is a scary thing. When we are called to live differently from family, friends, co-workers, it is scary. So when we look to those whose lives bear witness to the faithfulness of God, we are encouraged. We run behind them and we watch how they ran. We follow their gaze looking at Jesus and see how Jesus was faithful to them in their race. And we live differently because of it. We love differently because of it. We celebrate Christmas differently because of the joy set before us in Jesus. At Christmas, we often expect to find joy in family and in the giving and receiving of gifts. And there is a joy in that. But do not let the joy of sentimentality and of celebrating a holiday draw your eyes from the joy of Christ. I think that's one of the great dangers of Christmas, is that we get so caught up in the joy of celebrating a holiday. We get so caught up in the sentimentality of the holiday that it actually draws our eyes from Jesus. You know, I see bumper stickers that say, keep the Christ in Christmas, and I agree, but I'm not sure we always know what that means. The joy and the challenge of family can distract us from our role as God's mediators. The pleasure of living in a land of plenty and the pleasures of family time can be like weeds that choke out the word of God in us. They can entangle us and make us forget our role for which Christ purchased us. Keeping Christ in Christmas means more than telling a story. It means more than just reading the story of the birth of a baby in Bethlehem on Christmas morning. It means more than just keeping Jesus in Christmas as something that we look forward to. It actually, keeping the Christ in Christmas means looking forward to the return of Christ. We don't just look back to the Christmas event, we look forward to the return. It means looking forward to the goal set before us in running the marathon well, following in the footsteps of Christ, even if it means running the road of suffering that he ran. Keeping Christ in Christmas means looking to the living slain lamb and living out a life that matches the new song of giving him honor and praise and glory. It means bringing that new song with us as we go into a world to make disciples. Christmas is about keeping your eyes on Jesus, not on the safe little baby in the manger who doesn't ask anything of us, but of the living slain lamb who stands on the throne of God and draws all eyes to himself and says, are you going to live up to the calling I have placed on you with my blood? The living slain lamb is a far more challenging Jesus than the baby lying in the manger who doesn't even cry when he wakes up. Because Jesus is our joy, the joy of the risen Christ on the throne, carrying out the Father's will for the world, purchasing us to be his people, his kingdom, and his priests. This is the joy that surpasses circumstances. This is the joy that we look forward to. This is the joy that will keep us running the marathon of faith. This is the joy of the arrival of Jesus on earth, because this is what his arrival led to. And this is the joy of Christmas. Amen.